Hi, I'm Doc Searles. Sean Powers and I are going to talk to Richard Esplin this week about self-sovereign identity. That's coming up next. Floss Weekly is brought to you from LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company doesn't have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they are working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 596, recorded Wednesday, September 16th, 2020. Self-sovereign identity. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. Let LastPass improve your employees' experience while safeguarding your business from cyber threats. LastPass is the number one password manager. Visit LastPass.com/twit to find out how they can help you. And by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard helps enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. Hi, everybody. I'm Doc Searles. I'm joined this week by Sean Powers. We're going to be talking to Richard Esplin of Evernym about self-sovereign identity, open source community management, and other really good things after we get to our first sponsor for the show. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by LastPass. LastPass surveyed 700 IT and security professionals across a range of industries, from financial services to IT to retail. 82% of them say their business has been exposed to a risk due to poor identity and access management. Thankfully, LastPass can help you manage identities and promote good security behaviors while your employees are remote. You may want your employees to have secure password storage, for example. LastPass gives them their own vault for storing every app and web login they use. LastPass makes it easy and safe for employees to share logins while keeping access to corporate data safe. Single sign-on manages employee access in a centralized view, so IT always has insight into who has access to what and from where. Enterprise password management ensures oversight of shadow IT and enforceable policies across all password-protected accounts. Multi-factor authentication requires additional factors to prove a user's identity, while the use of biometric and contextual factors makes the process smooth for employees. Employees always have their passwords with them and can access them from anywhere, no matter where they're working, from any device. Working remotely should add convenience, not frustration. So you can rest easy knowing your business is secure with LastPass. They also use AES 256-bit encryption with, here comes like a license plate. This is not easy to say. I'll just say it anyway, but it's great. PBKDF2 SHA-256 and salted hashes ensures complete security in the cloud. Your data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level, so the data in your vault is secret from everyone, including LastPass. We use LastPass here at Twit, and our experiences are all 100% positive. We really depend on it. So LastPass is the number one password manager. Let LastPass securely manage your user's identity, letting your employees work efficiently without making your business vulnerable to cyber threats. Go to LastPass.com/twit. That's LastPass.com/twit.
You know, we use LastPass at my day job too, and I have personal LastPass. I've used LastPass for years, and when the company started using it, the Enterprise Edition, I was able to connect my personal account to it, so I don't lose all of my other passwords. It just kind of merges nicely. I've been a user for a long time, and I was worried that when the company switched over, I'd have to like abandon my personal account and just use the enterprise one. Thankfully, that's not the case.
Fantastic. It's a testimonial there. Thanks, Sean. So Our guest this week is Richard Esplin, who's with a company called Evernym. And he's one of the top authorities on self-sovereign identity. And this is something I've been on the identity case since the 90s. And it's a tough one. It's a really tough one. And to me, the most important thing about it is that the self, you and me, we need to be in charge of how we use our identities online. And in almost every case, every new solution for decades was like, let's have yet another corporate solution to this, and some corporation wins and you get crushed into IBM or Microsoft or Apple or somebody, and they run your whole life. And big companies have been wanting to do this forever. And self-sovereign identity is actually a happening thing. It's happening in the world today. So Richard's an open source advocate and an evangelist. He's got a master's degree in science and management, a degree in management science and engineering from Stanford, and a bachelor's in from BYU. Really knows his stuff. So welcome, Richard. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. I'm thrilled to be part of this illustrious show. I've watched for years, and I'm not as informed as some of your guests, but it's nice to be included in the lineup.
Yeah. On this one, you are. On this topic, you are. And you watch too. That's good. That's because we are on the little rectangle as well as in your headsets. So give us your top level summary, especially for open source advocates, which is our audience primarily, which are a lot of solo flyers, a lot of alpha. We're not just users here. You know, we're sysadmins. We're maintainers and committers, and we operate things that matter. But yet we're still, we don't want to just be users. We want to be in charge of our lives online. So tell us how self-sovereign identity works for us.
Yeah. I'll start with a little bit of a personal story. In college, I'm doing computer science and I'm in the Microsoft world. And I have a friend that introduces me to this thing called Linux. And I'm playing with it and I realize, wait, I want to know how the kernel works. I can just open it up and play with the kernel of the operating system. Like, this is awesome. Nobody can take these tools away from me. And it totally changed my view of the industry, of technology, that I could open the hood and I could own what I was working with. And I could build my skill set around these things. And over time, as I worked in different businesses and introduced open source, I came across actually your article on the ClueTrain Manifesto, Doc, and thought, this is exactly right. The way technology is being used is pushing us into these unequal relationships with vendors. And a couple of years ago, I came across your vendor relationship management stuff and thought, I should be in the center of how I interact with my digital relationships. Why is Google in the center of all my digital relationships? And I also read a lot of Code version 2 by Lawrence Lessig. That's a great treatise about the importance of technology in our modern society, and how if we're not careful, it can undermine democracy because there's no accountability and we need to be in control of our tools. We need to have rights as citizens. And when I had the opportunity to join Evernym, they're an digital identity company, and they're really worried about this thing called self-sovereign identity, where we put you in the center of your digital relationships. And it really struck a chord with me that, yes, this is the future I want to build, where we as citizens, we as active participants in democracy, our technology can't be taken away from us, our identity can't be taken away from us, that we interact with the world as peers, as equal peers with whoever else is on the internet. So that's a little bit about how I ended up here. The way to think about self-sovereign identity is that for thousands of years, we have expressed our identity through a credential, a document that comes from a government, or through some kind of symbol of authority, but we're in control of how we do that. A policeman can take his badge off at the end of the day. A king can take his crown off and pretend to be a commoner. At the same time, I use my driver's license and all sort of things that have nothing to do with driving. As an American, you use your driver's license all over the place. And the government doesn't know about that. But as soon as we move into the digital world, we say, oh, my employer is going to be in charge of my identity and take away whenever my employer wishes, or Facebook and Google. And that seems kind of strange. So we're trying to bring the world into this new era where we hold our identity credentials. Now, of course, nobody knows that they should trust me. They need to know that the issuer gave me that credential. And so we built really interesting technology that allows the verifier to look at the credential that I as a holder offer and say, oh, this credential was not tampered with and it really did come from that issuer that I trust. And therefore, I can trust the holder that gave it to me.
All right. Can I ask a question? Actually, two questions. And I'm not even going to let you say yes or no. Just do it. So when I was trying to figure out exactly, like to wrap my head around the idea of a sovereign identity, two things came to mind. One, I'm sure you remember OpenID. You know, that was like the way when you logged into a website and you didn't want to have to create an account there. OpenID was a great way where you controlled it and you controlled the login and password and how it was authenticated and you could log in. That seemed to have gone away. And now if you want to do that, you have to use like you said, either Google or Facebook or something to log into any website, which is just creepy as heck. But that was the first thing I thought of. And I'm curious, first of all, whatever happened to that? And is this part of that? Is it just authentication? I'll go with that first question then. Is it more than just authentication? Or is authentication the main thing? Is it a part of it? Am I off base completely?
So the technology of self-sovereign identity is about verifiable credentials and being able to say, I can prove certain things about myself as attested to by a third party that you trust, and you can do what you want with that information. So you as the verifier, you're not bound to accept my credential. You're not bound to do anything specific with that credential, but you probably will feed it into a workflow and say, oh, Richard has his employee credential, therefore he should be authorized. But you also might say, a couple of the use cases – I spent a long time working on the actual technology in the open source community at Hyperledger. But last 8 months, I've really been focused on user adoption. And two of the use cases that I've spent the most time with these are public. In the National Health Service in England, they're trying to do what they call a staff passport. When COVID hit, they've been playing with this for a long time, but when COVID hit, they had this problem where they had to move a doctor from one hospital to another really quickly. They're setting up tents and things. And it used to take a week for that doctor to get all the paper together, go to the new hospital, hand over all the paper, get the new work assignment, and show up for work. But in this way, the original hospital, the doctor shows up at HR and says, give me my credential. They send it to their phone. They go to the new hospital, they show their phone and scan the QR code, and the new hospital has all the information needed to know this person is certified in protective equipment and is a respiratory person, give him or her access to go work. And so it goes from a week down to a half hour of interaction. So what you see there is an authentication component, but the credentials are the key thing that you're moving. And, the National Health Service is gigantic. They've got all these different hospitals. They can't tie it all together. There's too many different systems. But by having the doctor as the person that moves between these silos carrying his or her information, the integration only has to be done over that open standard of the verifiable credential. And the back-end systems don't need to talk. And so it's much easier to put that together for that authentication use case. But then you can take that credential and go further and say, wow, now what kind of doctor are you? When was the last time you were certified? What's your specialty? And you can get all that information beyond the authentication use case.
Okay, so there's a bunch of data that can be stored and you still have control over it. The other thing that struck my mind is just a key pair, right? Just encrypted key pair, like public-private key pairs. So if it's more than just authentication, obviously OAuth was strictly like, I am who I am, let me in. So this is more than that. Is the concept a one-stop shop where everything is in one place and then you have control to grant access to that? Or is this a solution for multiple backends, if you will? You mentioned Hyperledger. So I guess what I'm trying to figure out for my own sanity, what does this look like in practice, right? I mean, using these types of awesome ideals, what does it look like on a Wednesday?
Yeah, and just to be clear, the OpenID Connect's not going away anytime soon, but the community is building integrations into that OpenID Connect workflow. And I expect we'll have integrations into other workflows as well, SAML, maybe even Google and Facebook. A couple other examples of how this works on a Wednesday. I work a lot on a project called MemberPass. MemberPass is a credit union consortium. It's a product for credit unions. It's done by a company called CLedger. And the problem with credit unions, they're smaller companies. They're not as big as a bank. You know, they're community owned. They don't have quite the IT budget. And when they had to shut down branches for COVID, there are certain transactions that they couldn't do under U.S. law because they didn't have high enough confidence in who they were talking to. So the way MemberPass works is that somebody goes in their credit union physically and says, I'm a member. And then they get this thing on their phone. And then later, if they call up because the branch is closed or for any reason, instead of having to do the, you know, what's your high school mascot? What was your first pet? You know, security questions. They just say, can you press the button on your phone right now? And you press the button on your phone. And then the person says, wow, you're fully authenticated. We can do whatever you want to do with your account. And instead of that being a 2-minute conversation, it's a 10-second conversation to get you authenticated. And then you can do your business. And that does require some plugins. With the back-end workflow of the credit union. Another example is the government of British Columbia. They published business licenses on their website. Any business in the province of British Columbia can say, hey, look, I'm a business, and you can go to this website and see that I have a valid license. It's run by the government of British Columbia. But they can also download that license and keep it as their digital credentials. So the government's holding it for businesses that aren't interested in having their own identity wallets, but anybody that wants to can pull that down. And they've actually sponsored an OpenID Connect integration for their legal use case, where legal transcripts are only available to the lawyers involved in the case. And so they issue a credential to the lawyer saying you're in the case. And then when they go to the website, please give me your credential on your phone, and you hand that to the website by scanning a QR code. And then the website does an OpenID Connect flow on the back end and says, okay, you can get all the transcripts for your case. And that preserves the privacy of all the litigants.
So
are those helpful use cases?
Those are. And actually, I'd like to go into sort of this new middle ground between individual self-sovereignty, which is the individual is a player in this in a serious way, and corporations actually adopting a new standard and adopting a new way of processing things, a new set of norms and conventions and ceremonies, because we've never had that before in the way that I think we're starting to see now. So I'm going to summarize one thing and then ask you a question based on that summary. Tell me if my summary is wrong. Because I've been around these conversations for a long time where one after another, we would come up with a great new idea that actually had self-sovereignty as its purpose, and then it went sideways. And two of those, in fact, were OpenID and OAuth. And OpenID you just went into, but OAuth was what turned into login with Google, login with Facebook, and so forth. That wasn't what we wanted to do in the first place, but that's what ended up happening. And so it was still, as Sean put it, it was all about authentication. It was all about authentication that relied on trust in some giant company so you could log in with one of those things. And at the corporate level, it just became simple because, oh, they're logging in with this or that. And it actually doesn't matter a lot. It isn't like with your bank. It's just like I'm getting into a website. That's a kind of lighter duty thing. So but what we're seeing now is, to me, self-sovereign identity is really simple. And tell me if my metaphor is wrong here. You've already got that in the everyday world with your wallet. Your wallet is a collection of credentials. Here's my driver's license. Here's my membership with AAA. Here's my school, you know, something that says I have parking at my school. Whatever it is, we carry like a pile of credentials inside our wallets. And we use them in a selective way to minimally disclose all that the other party needs to know and nothing more than that. You know, as Kim Cameron puts it, and who worked for Microsoft, minimum disclosure for constrained use and user control and consent. And we've talked about this stuff for years, but with SSI, for the first time, you mentioned CLedger and MemberPass, but there are just a lot of big companies that are getting onto this bandwagon. You look up self-sovereign identity now, and there's, you get 80, 100,000, 200,000 results on Google. So something's happening at the corporate level. And what I'd like to know is more about what's going on there and why is it attractive to them? But also, how is it not going to turn into log in with Facebook and log in with Google again?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And it's worth pausing for a minute on the word sovereignty that we keep using, especially when we talk to governments. They're like, you're saying that you don't need us? Self-sovereignty means you make up whatever you want about yourself? And that's not the term of sovereignty we mean. When we say sovereignty, we mean you're in control of your identity. But again, it's all about you holding credentials that are provided by somebody that's trusted by the verifier. So as you have these credentials together, somebody has to issue. And so there's two parts of benefit that I worry about a lot as a product person. The first benefit is, of course, to the user. They can have their sovereign identity on the internet. But the second benefit is the benefit that goes to the corporations or the issuers or the verifiers who are using these credentials to do useful things, because that's where the user gets benefit, is they can actually do something with these credentials. Where we see adoption taking off right now is where the issuer is the verifier. I need to give you a credential that I'm going to ask for again. And that's really easy because you don't have to standardize the credential schema. You don't have to negotiate with a third party. We call those governance frameworks where you decide in our ecosystem who's going to trust what. We're able to shortcut that whole piece of adoption because the person who's giving the credential out is the person who wants to consume it. Now, you make a point, though, about Google and Facebook. But the advantage is that because the advantage of the company is that the integration's a lot easier. The user who is taking the data around, and that makes things nice, and there's a lot of flexibility in how a credential's used. The advantage to the user is that even though the company can revoke the credential the same way that the state can revoke your driver's license, you still have the credential and can say it was valid at a certain point in time and be able to use that credential for various things. So depending on the level of trust that's required, you could use a credential that says, yes, I lived here at this point in time, even though I can't prove I live there now. Or yes, I did in fact work for such a company in the past, even though I can't prove I work there now. And so there's a lot of benefit to me being able to own that and control that. Now, the other benefit to the user is that I decide when I give it to people. And like you said, minimally disclosure, we should talk about zero knowledge proofs and minimal disclosure, selective disclosure, because it's super interesting from a technical perspective. But I can decide I only want to share this information. And it becomes a negotiation between me and the verifier, how much information is needed for me to get what I'm looking for from that verifier. And I can start to – it's not a binary yes or no. It's a, okay, for me to tell you I'm a human, I can do that immediately. But now I want to know you're an actual business before we proceed. Oh, now I know you're a business. Okay, here's what I'm trying to do. Oh, I want a loan. Okay, so I got to prove this additional stuff. And it becomes a back and forth where we have mutual trust instead of it all being one-sided like it is today.
Okay, so I have a question then. How would somebody in the open source community get involved then? Right. I'm interested in this. I'm here co-hosting, even though it wasn't one of the things that I was super familiar with. But I'm interested now. So what is a first step for me to do? I mean, I'm not a corporation, so I'm just an open source guy.
Yeah, excellent question. And my favorite question. A couple of episodes ago, you had Brian Bellendorf from Hyperledger talking about everything Hyperledger does. Most of the SSI projects I work in are in the Hyperledger Foundation. Which is a project at the Linux Foundation. At Hyperledger, there's three projects that are really applicable depending on your need. There's an identity working group that kind of ties it together. But the Aries project tries to define what this wallet agent looks like. This digital agent is the technology used to represent you on the internet or digitally. And it's got to hold those credentials and it's got to talk to other agents. So Aries is about creating those agents and making it easy for them to talk to each other. And there's some open source Aries agents. There's some free to use closed source Aries agents like the one I have the code will be available, but it's not under an Apache license for a period of time. And then there's purely proprietary Aries agents. And you can kind of play in that ecosystem, learn how they talk, see the interaction, set it up and use it yourself. Now, when we talk about a verifier trusting the credential the holder presents, the credential that comes from the issuer, how does that trust happen? The verifier has to look at some source of knowledge and say, yes, I can prove this has not been tampered with. And we use a distributed ledger for that, a blockchain. And Hyperledger Indy is the project for that distributed ledger. And that's where we put the issuer key, the signs, those credentials to show that the holder hasn't tampered with them. So that's a great place to play as well. Now there's a cryptography that's shared between all of this. You've got to secure the wallet. You've got to secure the communication. You've got to secure the ledger. And being able to secure that with this idea of zero knowledge proof selective disclosure, where I can get a credential that says a lot of things about me, but I'm only going to share one piece of it. That encryption technology is called zero knowledge proof. That is in a project called URSA. So if you really like the math, if you really like the cryptography, play in URSA. You'll find kindred spirits who love that stuff, and they're doing really interesting things on revocation and selective disclosure and just general perfect forward secrecy, all that kind of thing. So those are the three main projects where I play, and we're always looking for contributors. Ares is nice because it's very client-focused. And you can play in the toolkit as you want. There's some in JavaScript, some in Java, some in Python, some in .NET, all sorts. And there's mobile clients and cloud clients and all sorts of things. In Indy, it's really great for people to like distributed consensus and like running big, highly available systems and Byzantine fault tolerance and all that bit of blockchain-y stuff. And then, of course, URSA for cryptography is super interesting when you're really looking at the security implications and how the math works and all that piece.
So I have at least one question. I know Sean has some more. But first, I want to thank our other sponsor for the show and let you know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by Security Scorecard. Security Scorecard is the global leader in cybersecurity ratings and the only service with 1.5 million companies continuously rated. Their mission is to empower every organization with collaborative security intelligence because you are only as secure as those you work with. They help enterprises manage digital threats with a 360-degree view of cybersecurity health through a single pane of glass. Their patented rating technology is used by over 1,000 organizations for multiple use cases. Those include self-monitoring. With Security Scorecard ratings, you can evaluate your organization's cybersecurity risk using data-driven, objective, and continuously evolving metrics that provide visibility into your organization's information security control weaknesses. And with third-party risk management, instantly view the cybersecurity posture of any third-party vendors, partner, or suppliers to help you evaluate risk in your ecosystem. It can also allow them to find and fix cybersecurity risks and vulnerabilities across their externally facing footprint. They are also used for board and executive level reporting and in the insurance space for cyber insurance underwriting. Security Scorecard non-intrusively collects data from publicly available feeds across the internet for an outside-in perspective. The data is used to calculate scores across 10 key risk factor groups, such as patching cadence, application security, DNS health, network security, and endpoint security. An A to F grading scale helps companies easily understand and continuously monitor the cybersecurity posture of any organization. So companies with a C, D, or F are 5 times more likely to be breached. So you have to watch out for those. Security Scorecard Atlas is the leading cybersecurity questionnaire and validation solution that cuts through the questionnaire noise so you can find out your score and make your business cyber secure. Atlas's centralized platform leverages machine learning to automate the cybersecurity questionnaire exchange process for senders and receivers, making it 2 times faster, more accurate, and secure. Atlas is the only platform in the market that instantly maps cybersecurity rating data to individual responses, providing a true 360-degree view of risk. Cut the questionnaire cycle in half. Save hours with 20-plus industry standard questionnaires or their custom questionnaire wizard. Collaborate easily and securely with your team and third parties. Security Scorecard believes that every business has a right to its own cybersecurity rating. They were awarded Best Product Security Ratings by 2020 SC Magazine Awards. The combined power of Security Scorecard ratings and Atlas gives organizations a 360-degree view of cybersecurity for any company in the world. Sign up for your free account by visiting securityscorecard.com/twit. Check the score of your business and up to five others. To learn more and sign up for your free account, visit securityscorecard.com/twit. Okay, so a question that I have is, let's say it's 5 years from now. I'm online. Anybody's online. SSI, self-sovereign identity, is a thing. We all understand ourselves to be self-sovereign at this point, meaning we're in charge of our lives online in a way that we can selectively present our identity credentials on an as-needed basis to other parties that don't need to know more than we're willing to reveal. What does that look like? I mean, we in the physical world, we have wallets. Wallets do this, right? But in the online world, Google's tried a wallet, you know, Amazon's tried a wallet. They're, you know, the big bigs want to own that part of your life. That's not going to work. We don't want them to own it. What does it look like? I mean, what do I have? What does any of us have that is our SSI instrument?
Yeah, there was a survey, I forgot who did it a little while ago, that said that most people can, if they lose their physical wallet, they'll notice within hours, but if they lose their phone, they notice within minutes. And I expect we'll just walk around with our phones and leave that wallet thing at home. I find more and more people don't walk around with a wallet anymore. They just use their phone. And currently, you have to download a digital wallet, an identity wallet, to hold these credentials. In the future, I expect that gets baked in. It's the iOS or Android or whatever we're using in 5 years will have this verifiable credential piece baked in. And we'll be able to go around and say, hey, you know, I am showing you, a soccer coach, that I am, in fact, the person authorized to pick up this kid because I'm picking up my nephew, you know, and I can show the parent authorized me to do that. I can say, hey, I'm police officer. I can show you that I'm authorized to use this car that I borrowed, even though I was speeding. But it's not my car. It's not stolen, but because I can show the authorization. You know, I look forward to the day when verifiable credentials are a key part of our life so that our in-person interactions can be more trusted. And we can do things we can't do today because you never know who you're talking to, whether that's online or in person. We can start to say, hey, I have a way to prove what I'm saying. You know, spam becomes less of an issue. Fraud becomes less of an issue. Privacy becomes a common expectation because I don't have to tell you something if you can't tell me who you are. And we live in this place where we have an easier time knowing what we're doing when we interact with the world around us.
So, okay, along with that then, my previous question was, how would somebody like myself, interested in open source, get involved? You did mention losing a wallet. This is literally true, and this isn't prep for the show. I lost my wallet 2 days ago, and I cannot find it. thankfully, I have things on my phone where I can actually buy things if I need to using digital versions of credit cards, but that's beside the point. My question is to do with, like, my local credit union. Okay, I'm a big credit union fan. Just recently, due to the pandemic, my local credit union has finally gotten an app and you can do remote deposit of checks. Okay, this is cutting edge for my credit union. How could I convince a credit union to adopt some sort of some version of this sort of a thing going forward? Because it took me, probably not, I hope not just me, constantly contacting them saying, you know, we need to be able to communicate with the bank digitally. You know, you should have an app. You should have the ability to do anything online. How can we encourage corporations or companies or banks or soccer coaches to adopt this kind of methodology for proving who we are?
Yeah, it's important to recognize that this is new technology, and we do need to make sure it's fully baked depending on what use case we're looking for. But credit unions is great because MemberPass exists, and you can request that just like you requested your check deposit app. But really, as we interact with companies and organizations and say, we want to know who you are before we share information, and we want to be in control of what information we share and provide that consistent pushback, that provides a lot of incentive for organizations to move towards an SSI model. Honestly, a major incentive for organizations to adopt SSI comes from the regulatory aspects. A lot of businesses that reach out to us for an SSI solution like it because it's GDPR compliant, or it's compliant with the California Privacy Act or the Canadian privacy laws. That regulatory framework creates a market and an incentive for the market to solve this problem. And SSI is a ready-made solution for a lot of these. So, of course, that's always something we can do in a democracy.
Cool. So just pretty much what I've been doing, encouraging them to look forward as opposed to looking backward.
All right. Absolutely. Cool. Now, you raise a good point about losing your wallet. That's a question I get all the time. So what happens when I lose my phone? And there's a couple of different answers. The answer today is just like your wallet, you contact the people that gave you a credential and you – well, actually, today you can restore from backup, so that's an option, depending on which identity wallet you use. Then if that doesn't work, you can go get those credentials reissued just like you would today with your physical wallet. In the future, though, there's some nice benefits that a digital solution has. You can do things like shard up your recovery password and hand it out to your friends. And if six of them agree that you are really who you say you are, then you can restore your wallet. And there's different ways we can do this over the long term that people are working on today that'll make recovering from a lost device or a lost physical wallet much easier.
Better than saying where I was born and my mother's maiden name and my second grade teacher's name and all of those things that the Facebook memes have you put on there for everybody to see. Anyway, that's a whole story.
Exactly. That is exactly the case.
So I have a question that we always bring up at some point, and I know it's relevant in the case of SSI, which is blockchain. Blockchain always comes up. But I know from having hung out around this long enough and listening in on lots of conversations, and as you know, This is an area where my wife is far more involved than I am, and so I'm often overhearing her conversations with you and other people, and that's distributed ledgers. That it's not so much blockchain as the kind of database in a more broad way we could call a distributed ledger. So I'm wondering if you could, and that's one reason you're Indy's at Hyperledger, which is all about that kind of thing. So if you want to go into that a little bit more deeply, that'd be cool.
Absolutely. And I do have to say with a little chagrin, being somebody who spends as much time on Hyperledger as I do, I'm not a fan of blockchains for most solutions. it saddens me how often I work with a client and they say, we need a blockchain. And you're like, do you really need a blockchain? And yes, because the CEO says we need a blockchain. And when you dig in, and we're going to control all the nodes ourselves, and you think, what's the advantage over just a big database if you're going to control
the nodes? There's a Dilbert cartoon in here somewhere, right?
Exactly. Yeah. If you don't need to distribute the trust, what blockchains do great, distributed ledgers do great, is you distribute the consensus. You distribute the view of reality so nobody can cheat. And if that's your problem, like identity, that's a problem, it's a wonderful solution. But a lot of people want to run their own identity ledger that only they control, and you think, okay, there's no value here. So blockchain is great for identity. It's great for payments, actually, because you have the same problem of making sure nobody can cheat. Certain supply chain use cases, I think Brian Bellendorf did a great job of describing where blockchain succeeds. But it surprised me how often, from a technical perspective, it's super cool tech. But from a I need this in my business perspective, I'm surprised how many people use it and don't realize that it just complicates everything.
Yeah, it's kind of like you want to, hey, we need the hot new thing. We need it to be distributed, but we want to be in total control, right? And that's there's a contradiction in here somewhere.
Absolutely. And we tease about it being the blockchain fairy dust. You're going to sprinkle it on your project. And it's actually just dust. It doesn't actually work. Now, when you're mentioning your wife, I should say I'm very impressed. She's such a capable leader. We interacted with the Sovereign Foundation. Indy is the open source technology for distributed ledger. And a lot of people take Indy and play with it, and you can deploy it. But then you have to figure out, if I have an Indy node in an Indy network to manage these credentials, the issuing keys, how do I govern that so that we can trust each other and we're working together? And the Sovereign Foundation is a public utility for identity, or the Sovereign Network and the foundation that runs it. And you elect trustees and everybody has a voice, and you work together to make sure that it is, in fact, a trustworthy, not controlled by any single entity, government, technology kind of ecosystem. So again, blockchain makes a lot of sense when you have a governance over that defines how those interactions happen. And that's what Sovereign does, that solves a lot of these problems that come from just, I'm going to throw up my Indy and start using it.
So I'd like to ask a bit about the dealing with community, because I know that you've done a couple things that I think are relevant here. I mean, one is that you've actually studied how open source works in the world and the history of it. A number of the talks you've given that we find online, if people look you up online, they'll find you giving some pretty good overview of open source history and where it came from. I was around for some of that. I mean, back in the 80s when AT&T was trying to own and run Unix and all the patent wars and the rest of it, I worked with Sun on some of that and what ended up being Solaris as a kind of alternative. But what's interesting to me now is how does one run community with this? Because you've actually mentioned a number of different communities in one, because one may be for Aries and Ursa and all the other constellations that are spinning off. I remember when it was just Indy and sitting at IIW while Nathan George, one of your colleagues, was talking about, well, now Indy's here, but we're going to put Aries over there, and there'll be multiple communities here. Well, how do those turn into maintainers and committers and into standalone, you know, things that actually work for communities?
This is a great topic, and I'd love to spend a very long time on it, but I'll try to be really brief. Our experience at Evernym, I've found to be a really valuable lens to look at through community engagement and open source. And I should say, I've worked my previous role, I did content management at Alfresco, open source, but that was vendor controlled. I worked on the Activity Project, which was a community workflow project. And I worked in Drupal previously. I've been able to play in a lot of different open source communities. At Evernym, before I joined, they had this idea for digital identity that anybody can use. They build a lot of the tech, and they said, hey, for this to actually work, we need a non-vendor-controlled ecosystem that runs the ledger. And they handed all this tech to Sovereign. And Sovereign, you know, we worked well with Sovereign. That went really well. Sovereign said, hey, in order for this to be really solid technology, we need to broaden the contributor community. So they handed the open source project for Indy to Hyperledger, and we got a bigger contributor community. In Indy, we said, well, but the ledger doesn't really matter if you haven't agreed on how the agents are going to talk. And so we spun out Aries and got a new group of contributors that are worried about agent communications. And then we said, actually, the order was the other way. We actually said, hey, the cryptography, we need to make sure it can be used in various places and really hardened. So we spun out Ursa, got a new group of crypto people that were really focused there. And then in Aries, we said, well, but implementing the open source is different from the standard. We need the governance around the around how these protocols talk, around the governance frameworks of who trusts what. And we recently, this year, spun out a new foundation called Trust Over IP that's also a Linux Foundation project that just manages that trust layer of how do you manage governance and those agreements between parties. In each of these steps, our contributor community got bigger, but that also required us to revisit a lot of conversations we previously had because they're new stakeholders and we're meeting more use cases. And so there's this interesting tension between getting lots of contributors, but also finishing things so we can take it to market and getting things that customers will adopt. And that's been a really interesting struggle for me to find what are the right incentives for each participant in the ecosystem to want to contribute. And what are the right incentives for my employer to want to contribute? And then how do we bring that back out of the community and turn it into something customers will pay for so that we can continue to fund the development? And that there are a lot of learnings that came out of that process. A very diverse group of stakeholders and a lot of arguments, but a lot of really valuable collaboration. Sean, you asked me about open source in general. Open source is so much fun because you meet these wonderful people that are great technologists and really passionate, and you just solve problems. But it's also very tiring because people are willing to invest a lot of effort to get to meet their needs, and you got to find that consensus. The incentives can be rather tricky, but really rewarding when you get it right to see that flywheel working as people innovate.
So this is my trifecta of how do we solve all the world's problems. First, I was talking about how open source people, like you were just talking about, like us, can be excited and get involved. Then how can we get corporations to be interested? The next one, it might be trickier, and you probably don't have an answer because I'm not sure there is one, but maybe there is, and you can help me out. The person on the street who is not passionate about technology, they're not passionate about privacy, they're not passionate about anything except, you know, getting a sucker when they go to the bank. How can we get people to put trust into something that they don't recognize? You know, you were mentioning a bunch of projects, several businesses that most people have never heard of. So if somebody has the option of, well, I can, you know, I trust Google, that made my heart hurt a little bit, but, you know, I trust Google or I trust Apple with my stuff because I know that they're legit. I mean, there is some truth to that concept, right? At least you know they're legit, rather than putting trust of my identity into a company that I may or may not know, even though, because the idea of, well, you're not putting the trust in the company, it's yourself. How do we get that truth or that concept across to the masses, right? My wife does, if I said Hyperledger, she wouldn't know what I was talking about. But if I said Google, she'd know, oh yeah, I know Google. So how do we bridge that gap? What's the next step? Or is it going to be technologists like ourselves getting on board and actually doing it? You know, my family uses a password manager now finally, and they didn't for a long time. They use sticky notes on their laptops. Is it just that? Do we need to pave the way for a better future? Or is there some way that we can convince people that it's better for them to not just trust the big names?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. It's a hard one. And this is where I disagree from a lot of other people in the open source community, in that trying to make this my living for 20 years, I see the value in investors and good marketing. There really is a difference when a company can come in and say, look, we market your privacy. You know, Apple has done really well at that, in marketing the privacy. And being able to make it something people think about and compare other vendors against, and being able to say, we give you control over your data. The open source message of putting the user in control is something that does resonate with people, but it has to be packaged in a way that's easy to consume. And that packaging is expensive, and it takes a business model. So there are, you know, Mozilla has done a great job doing that with a community model, but it's really hard to scale that across all sorts of industries. And that's where I've really enjoyed being part of an open source business, because we can go to businesses and say, look, have you compared this against the alternatives? And especially as we move into the 21st century, as we're in this 21st century, I find our generation is relearning a lot of the vendor-controlled, a lot of the tragedies from vendor-controlled ecosystems of the 80s and 90s. But we're able to say, hey, look, what worked in the 90s? Open source worked. You know, putting the user in control worked. And being able to make that a key part of the way we brand and the way we message and the way we bring products to market, it does resonate. I call it the open source procurement preference. I do find when I'm selling to companies that people prefer open source, not just the company. A lot of them have policies these days that they want to procure open source, but the individuals you're talking to like open source, and it makes a difference. It's hard to quantify, but it has been the difference between winning and losing deals quite frequently over the past year for us.
So a couple of thoughts following on to that. One is that, we've gone an awful long way in the world with Linux actually ending up running everything without it ever becoming a household word for most people. Most people don't know.
I think next year is the year of Linux on the desktop, isn't it? That's what I heard.
yeah, exactly. Linux on the desktop.
And the year after.
And I am one of the alpha perpetrators of that myth. You know, I don't know how many times in Linux Trust. Yeah, here it comes. Here it comes. You know, geez, KDE and GNOME look an awful lot like Windows. That'll work for you, right? You know, and it didn't quite happen. And yet it sort of did. So, but I'm thinking that there may be companies behind the scenes. I mean, ARM is another one of those, right? You know, I mean, everything's running on ARM now, or is it going to be running on ARM? Nobody knows what ARM is, other than they've got one hanging off the side of their body. But they don't know that the chip design in their phones is an ARM, and in many other devices as well. And so I'm wondering, and you work for one of those companies with Evernim. Not that you have to pitch Evernim right now, but and maybe it isn't the company that ends up being in that role. But I think that there are roles behind the scenes that can result in consistency, like WebKit did for apps on phones. You know, nobody knows what WebKit is, but one of the things that made a lot of apps look similar was WebKit. At least on iPhones, I think. But that's probably not the best example. But I think there may be facilitators back there that are likely to emerge. Maybe this is a blank space that somebody can fill in, or maybe it is an actual company. But I'm wondering what you think about that.
Yeah, little story. My mother-in-law came to me because she had one of those Microsoft tech support scam artist telling her computer was hacked. And I said, you don't use Microsoft. And she says, I don't use Windows. No, you haven't used Windows in over 10 years when I put Linux on your machine. But she didn't have to make the decision. It just happened. We just took care of things and it works fine for her. And that's when technology really gets adoption, when it becomes invisible. Whether it's self-sovereign identity or whether it's your operating system or whether it's your mobile device, these things become invisible. They become part of our lives. And that extra polish to, you know, the technology is part of it, but there's a lot that goes into the packaging. There's a lot that goes into the documentation. There's a lot that goes into the training and the distribution channel and setting up the incentives that get people to use this technology and get work done. Because, no, it takes weird people like us to be excited over the latest update to your phone. Usually, they just want to be able to make calls, browse the web, you know, do whatever they're doing on their phone. And that's what Evernim's goal is for SSI. But every open source company I've worked for, that is the goal, is to be able to package this for broad adoption without undermining the user's control of their technology. And that's what's so powerful, is that we can have both. It takes investment. It takes hard work. It takes people recognizing the benefits, which is a lot easier when bad actors take advantage of proprietary ecosystems. But it is happening bit by bit over time. I don't expect one day to wake up and say everybody's using these things, but I do expect day by day to say, oh, look, everybody knows what this is. They understand what we're talking about. We're making progress. And it's so exciting to come to work every day and see us move down that adoption slope.
We're getting toward the end of the end of our hour. And I have a brief question before we go into our final ones, which is that, will we ever get past somebody on the other side of the counter saying, give me your ID, where they're asking for something else? Because, I mean, your ID is, though it is a verifiable credential, right? That's let me see your ID, meaning just show me a driver's license or a passport or something that works. But we're so used to our identity being an official one of some kind rather than one that is our own. That is the really, to me, the interesting social hack of SSI, of self-sovereign identity, meaning that it's mine. You know, I am who I say I am, right? In my case, you know, I'm known as Doc to an awful lot of people, and I'm known as David to other people. I mean, when I show a verifiable credential, it's sometimes it's Doc and sometimes it's David, depending on the context. You know, the books I've written say Doc on them. The driver's license I carry says David. But I understand that, I mean, I don't think of it as self-sovereign, but in a vernacular, in a formal way, the physical world really is one where we are self-sovereign because we have wallets and we can selectively disclose. We don't think of it that way. We still sort of wait toward the corporate big brotherish side of this. And I'm wondering what the crossover point looks like, what that's going to feel like.
Yeah, I can't say when the crossover point will happen, but the vision that I see, there comes a when we talked about trust over IP and the governance frameworks they're creating to be able to say what we should trust for what, is that becomes widespread and is we all have digital agents. I expect the time comes where you walk into a store and the store says to your device, prove you're over 21 or prove you live in the state to get a resident discount. You know, you, when you go to the ski lift, it should just know I live in the state. But with machine learning, with really intelligent mobile devices, powerful IoT devices, we should be able to say, I should be able to put in and say, my rules are, I don't care if somebody knows I live in Utah. I don't care if somebody knows that I'm over 21, but don't you give them my address and don't you give them my birthday. And I should be able to set those parameters. And in most interactions today where people say, give me your ID or they just don't let you interact because they don't trust you enough, we get that minimum level of confidence immediately with no – it's just invisible because that's the best technology. And only when we go to the next level where it's, it says, you know, I need a loan, I'm applying for a job, that's when people are going to say, okay, who actually issued this credential? Is it, it – you know, let's inspect the next level of detail. You know, initially, I can automatically say I'll accept any age credential that comes from any of the following sources. I can do that automatically. And my device can say, I'll respond to that request to anybody within the following parameters, and I can put those guidelines. I expect the day comes where our devices figure out our preferences and respond with the right level of information based on our history for the different interactions we're in. And it's only when somebody tries to exceed those thresholds that we have to get involved and say, okay, here's my actual driver's license and all the details associated with that. Here's my, you know, medical certificate or whatever.
So we're at the end of our hour, and very briefly, we always close with several questions. And the first one, I'll just ask you to be as short as you can with it, and then we go into the others, which is there anything we haven't asked that you would like us to have asked?
Oh, this was a good conversation. I love talking with people that are excited about the same things I am, and I would love to have more of these conversations. But I think we covered a good batch today.
That's great. No, this is great, and you've been a great guest. So. What are your favorite scripting languages and text editors?
I'm most comfortable in Python. I do almost everything in Python. I use ZSH whenever I'm in the shell, and my muscle memory is Vi. I have to say it's actually Vim key bindings into Dvorak, which throws everybody off. But that's what I do.
into Dvorak.
That may be the best nerdiest answer.
I
just push it up
every time
my
kids touch my computer, they're like, the letters don't do what they say they'll do, Dad. Nope, they don't.
That's wow. Awesome. Are you using a Dvorak keyboard by any chance? Or?
No, I use a QWERTY keyboard, and it's got the I can type reasonably fast with QWERTY. I touch type pretty good in QWERTY, but I do much better in Dvorak, and my wrists don't hurt anymore. So, yeah, I do Dvorak just whatever keyboard I'm at. I just switch it to Dvorak and type away.
Wow. We should have John C. on sometime and see what he says. That's been fantastic. This has been a really great show, and I really appreciate your coming on. I think this is an incredibly important topic, and I hope some of our viewers and listeners follow up on it. We'll put some in show notes and things and socialize as much of it as we can, because I think it really matters.
Your co-host learned a lot. So I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
This is our job here. We're here to educate the co-host.
That's right. Yeah. So thank you for that. I appreciate that.
The co-host is educating the host in my case. You know, I've sometimes joked that I was, you know, for Linux Journal for the longest time. Like even from the beginning, I was like the oldest and least technical guy on staff. Anyway. So it's
definitely been an honor. Thanks for inviting me. And I should say, Sean, the next level in learning, Manning has a book coming out this fall called Self-Sovereign Identity, and it's got 30 chapters by different authors. That'll be a great way for people to want to learn more about the use case, everything from use cases to the actual technology.
Cool. Can we get that in the show notes too?
Yeah.
Because that's
absolutely
all right.
Put everything in that we can. Well, thanks so much. And we have to have you back on.
Oh, it'd be my pleasure. So exciting.
Yeah. Take care. So Sean, I'm curious what stuck for you. I mean, what at a top level, what stuck for you?
So what stuck for me? I get it a little bit more. Like, we're not talking just about authentication, although authentication is part of it, right? To be able to prove who you are, to authenticate to whatever, but being in control of all of your data. There's still a lot of things that I'm not 100% confident on. You know, if there's all of these competing open things, is everybody going to just accept whatever? Will you have companies that say, oh yeah, we don't accept that form of authentication that you're doing? There's probably a lot of things that are going to work out in the laundry. One of the concerns I have, though, is that it's such a great idea that a big company is going to take it and run with it. And then all of a sudden they are going to warehouse everybody's data. And even though that's not a good idea, it's going to be the easy idea for the masses. It'll probably be built right into the Google phone. And so that's a concern that I have. Hear me being the naysayer and the pessimist, right?
Well, I'm hoping if it does get built in, it gets built in like the QWERTY keyboard or the, or the phone keypad does, where it's just an understood thing. But that's a bit of a risk. I don't think that hoarding data is by the big companies is that big an issue. I think it's more in part because we're kind of at the end of the big data era, at least in terms of a fad, because having too much data, especially personal data on people, thank you, Europe and California, has turned into a toxic asset. And the upside, and this is me talking my own pluggy thing, but the upside of having infinite data about people so you can market to them is not as leveraged as people have thought it has been for a long time. And that, in fact, in their selves, you know, we as self-sovereign people actually don't want to be sold to at all times. And we don't want to look like a customer to everybody at all times. And we don't want to be at the end of the barrel of endless marketing at all times. And I think the appetite for that on the corporate side is going to decline. That the question for me is how this becomes normative. I mean, how does this become normal? What does it look like? You know, I think the wallet as a metaphor really works from the physical world, but I'm not sure what we'll have as a wallet. We'll have something else, and it may not be a thing. It's just a state. Yeah. It's something that's inherent, and it could be, if Google and Apple build it deeply enough into the way that phones work and computers work, then it becomes something like, you know, dashboards all look like this, you know, and it's gonna, and they all work this way, and they all tell you the same kind of thing.
And you're right. As a people group, we are conscious about privacy now. And I think it's the big company's success that did them in, right? I mean, everybody's creeped out by ads that know what you're thinking before you say it. And so people are concerned about privacy of their data. And when I say people, I don't mean the nerdly among us. I mean everyday people. You know, I think about my family members who are not terribly tech savvy. They are conscious about their data privacy more than I expected. They just are.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, to me, it's a little off topic, but I think it's appalling to find that Apple had something called ID for advertisers. That was your ID for advertisers. It was an ID. It was a verified credential, you know, that you walked around with without ever knowing you had it and could opt out of. But, and I think they're going to kill that, or they're going to change it to something else. I mean, it's going to be a real sea change. I think that they're going to drive that to some degree, but whether or not, you know, your Apple ID and what you do with your Apple ID becomes your self-sovereign something, I think that's the mistake that's been made over and over again, going back to Passport with Microsoft, you know, two decades ago. So I'm optimistic about that. I'm also mindful of time. So what would you like to plug, Sean? This is plug time.
Oh yeah, plug something. My YouTube channel. That's the not Richard Esplin, even though that's what it says on my lower third.
their lower third. But Richard may still
be
around.
Channel,
so if you
want YouTube.com/ Sean Powers with a zero for the O. I've just been starting to post things on YouTube again, and I hope to see everybody there. I think it's your fault, Doc. You got me on video again, and now I'm addicted.
I know. We opened the dam, and now the water's flowing through, and it's all shown everywhere. I should add that one of the biggest attractions at Linux Journal for our last few years there as an operative thing was Sean's videos. I mean, so Sean was our video star at Linux Journal, and I think he does a great job. So I'll plug you too.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I'm not hard to find, so I could kind of come self-plugged. So thanks a lot, Richard, and thank you, Sean, and thank you, everybody. And I am, as usual, unprepared to see who's on for next week. So, but trust me, it's going to be good. Thank you very much for another Floss Weekly.
Hi, I'm Jason Howell, host of All About Android, where each week I'm joined by my co-hosts Florence Ion and Ron Richards, and we talk about everything that has to do with Android. Is it news? Is it hardware? Is it apps? Well, you name it, we talk about it. We invite guests from the industry on the show. We even sometimes have people from the Android team themselves talking about what makes Android so great. And you could subscribe so you don't miss anything about the world of Android by going to twit.tv/AAA. We'll see you there.